hour of me going.
We should.
To everything.
To everything. Just laughing hysterically.
It was the Hanna-Barbera Wacky or Laugh Olympics dog.
Well, there's wacky races in Laugh Olympics.
Was it Muttley? The dog Muttley. Who was always like, we can't even do it.
Muttley, I'm glad you pulled that one out.
I'm turning into the Muttley of the marathons. Are we on?
He was in both of them, wasn't he? But no, it was, I think he's different characters in each one. Muttley was definitely in Laugh Olympic with the Really Rottens.
Oh, yeah.
Because there
yeah.
was the Scooby-Doobies and the Yogi Yahooies. And then Muttley was with the Really Rottens. But whoever the guy with the snidely whiplash mustache who would fly the... And
oh,
he's from Wacky
yeah.
Races.
Yeah.
And he had a sidekick that was very Muttley-ish. But I think it had a different name.
Everybody under 50 is tuning out right now.
Wasn't it Penelope Pureheart who was the... I'm looking up Wacky Races now.
This is compelling radio, everybody.
Wacky Races. Let's see.
Didn't think you'd hear this when you tuned in now, did you? When you yeah. pressed that download link on this podcast, did you really think you would hear a debate about Wacky Races?
When are we going to do the podcast about...
Wacky Races.
Yeah, about Wacky Races.
The oral history of Wacky Races.
Did you ever watch... Dirk Dastardly.
Dirk Dastardly.
It was Muttley.
It all started when I was 8, and the USA Network reran these every night at 6 o'clock on Cartoon Express.
And then Professor Pat, real... Penelope Pitstop.
By the way, we are going to get to marathon stuff. No, this is not the wrong podcast that you downloaded. So don't worry.
This is the Wacky Races. Let's check. See, Muttley, was he also in... Yeah, see, there's a picture of him.
There's Muttley. None of you can see it right now, but there's Muttley
laughing
with the evil laugh, the horse laugh that he does, and horse as in HORSE.
Now I'm looking up Laugh Olympics. You want to start us off while I'm doing this? We already have the music playing.
Yeah, I'm just going to hum along to that again.
That's just annoying.
So, many of you have probably been asking, hey, where's the marathon chat? We haven't heard that in a long time. What's going on? Kevin and Joe, did you quit? Well, we had this little event called Shock Around the Clock, the 7th annual Ohio 24-Hour Horror Marathon. That's what I get for not doing my Picard face when I'm saying
Mumbly
that.
Was the...
Mumbly.
From
I'm
Laugh
sorry.
Olympics.
How could I...
And it was Dread Baron.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess apparently there was some copyright issues inside of Hanna-Barbera at
possibly,
the time.
I don't know. Well, thank God that's been settled. Shit. Yeah, we had...
He
had
looks
the...
like McGruff the Crime Dog's
oh,
like
yeah.
rapey brother.
I've been scarred now. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we had the 7th annual Ohio 24-Hour Horror Marathon, Shock Around the Clock, mm-hmm. Almost a month ago now.
Won't we survived?
Everybody survived. Everybody's still here. But yeah, we kind of ran into a time gap with that, so we have not been able to get to our award-winning marathon chat oral history of the events since
we have
then.
Never been able to give you your oral business.
Hello!
Wow.
All yeah, right. High quality.
Is there anything you need to say about the last marathon? Anything that you want to point out?
It was fun. A lot of, and this was unintentional, but a lot of penis-based violence. See Death.
And then there were the movies.
Yes, that too. See Deathgasm. It's a lot of fun. It's a ton of fun.
There was a lot of those foreign people. They love penis-based violence.
I think they do. Yeah. Most people made it through Mr. Hyde's 36-centimeter erection.
Or Mr. Hyde made it through some people.
He made it through some people,
with
too.
His 36-inch. No, 36-centimeter.
No. Centimeter. Wow. Come on now. We have to get our erection sizes right. Let's not be cagey about that.
You could hurt somebody with 36 inches.
You probably could.
I have 36 inches if you measure it up to my heart.
I'm so baffled right now. That
That was my
why did you? Why
laugh.
Did you have to blow my? Yeah, that was. Why did you have to laugh. Destroy my mind like that? No, it was fun. It was a good time, and people had a good time. And German Angst was not as angsty as we even thought.
German Angst, you know what? I still don't know what to think about German Angst. I wasn't wild about it. I liked Shock Value better. I know there was. I brought a friend, to the marathon. He was
Kevin does
from
have
out
a friend,
town,
believe it or not.
And he was saying after a shock value, he was saying, oh, it was terrible. You have to have a plot. I go, you've not seen very many student films. You have to. I'm like, there is no rule. There is no film commission that says we'll allow you to call this a film because it has a plot in it.
People who say this had no plot, I often take issue with, because I think there were plots in all of those films. They were thin plots, that's for sure. But there was a progression of events that happened and which led to something.
Maybe not all of them.
Such as? No, I'm not even. No, no, no. We have to get to the main event.
Okay.
We're going to get off on a weird tangent about this.
Ding, ding, ding. Enough with the penis-based violence.
Because I know a lot of you are tuning in. We're 4 or 5 minutes into this now, and you're tuning in thinking, hey, I tuned in because I want to hear about the final two Studio 35 horror marathons. Yeah. Give me a break. So, okay. We're going to talk about those, because last time we devoted an entire podcast to the Arena Grand years of the Sci-Fi Marathon. Well, at the same time, the Studio 35 24-hour horror marathons were entering their flush, their purple patch, their purple period.
Speaking of 36-inch erections.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so the thing that many of you know about these marathons who were there is these two were a real high point, 2002 and 2003, and that was because of the two guests that we had. A little context, because this is something that is very much a look at the past, but it's also kind of a look ahead to the future, or to the present, that is, and where we are now in terms of the marathons. People often ask us, you know, we had Bruce Campbell in 2002, he came out. You know, why don't you bring out more people like him? And there are a lot of factors that go into that. When we brought Bruce Campbell and George Romero to Studio 35 in 2002, 2003, we had 342 seats we could sell. 350, because we always sold 8, and we said basically those are bar seats. Like, you'll probably sit at the bar if you show up. You might be able to get into the theater. Mm-hmm. Even having those extra 50 seats helped immeasurably in keeping ticket prices down. We were also an independent theater back then. Studio 35 was owned by one person. It answered directly to them, and that was it. That was the bottom line.
Yeah.
When we brought Bruce Campbell in 2002, we paid $4,000 to bring him in. I try not to toss around numbers too much, but it's for context.
But he's bragging at this point, so you're just going to have
to. We paid $4,000 out of my own pocket. No, not quite.
I don't know if that's true.
So, we realized, hey, if it's going to be $4,000, we need to charge this much minimum for tickets so we can make some money on top of
it. If it's going to be $4,000, why not $5,000?
Yeah, that's what
you
Udo said.
You would certainly play six.
So, we knew we could do that. We took a bit of a gamble with Bruce Campbell.
Oh, nice.
We did. Well, we didn't know if...
The itsy bitsy spider.
We didn't know if that many people would come out, but they did. Mm. But we had enough seats to say, if we sell, say, 250 to 300 at this amount, then we'll make our money back. We'll be fine. Mm. And it was a piece of cake. But things have changed. You know, we ran into a real coup, I guess, or a real a convergence of events when we had these two guys back to back, both of who cost around $4,000. Other guests sometimes are much more expensive. Some guests sometimes are way more expensive, and you're not sure if you can get the money either through ticket sales or through getting money from like an outside sponsorship to bring them in. It really does come down to the individual guest. A lot of times it's, hey, we want to bring somebody in, and we've talked about this before. We often bandy around John Carpenter and David Cronenberg as guys we've always wanted to bring in. Now, the process for that today would be, okay, let's talk to their people, see how much they would want, if they're available.
Can we get Tom Atkins?
Or Tom Atkins. Yeah. I don't even know how much Tom Atkins would want.
Probably a pack of cigarettes. Six pack of Miller beer.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that some people forget is people want money to appear at these things. Mm. Big, the fairly major names, even if they're like a carpenter and they haven't made a notable film.
Carpenter, like Jesus?
Like Jesus, yeah. John Carpenter still wants money because he's still a name. even the smaller.
It's also his time. I mean, it takes a day or two to travel and, you know.
But I mean, they it's not like we can go to Carpenter and say, hey, here's like $400. Come out and see us and we'll pay for your airplane.
Could we ask Will Wheaton to do it and offer him exposure? You're not following trends on the internet, are you?
No, I am. I'm not.
He wrote a scathing piece about the Huffington Post wanting to pay him with exposure to.
Oh, well, I could go off on a rant about that, even though I'm not Will Wheaton. Yeah, that was nice. No, but people want money, and even smaller names want money.
Like Will Wheaton, it's a much smaller name than John Carpenter, which is much longer.
That was a nice visual you just had. I'm getting very aroused now. Thank you. I wish I had a little slide whistle sound effect.
Yeah.
Well, take for example Stuart Gordon when he came in 2009. Yeah. We paid. I don't think this is too far out of school to say this. We paid. I think it was around $2,500 total to bring Stuart Gordon in.
When you say total, that including hotel airfare. Okay.
And he was someone who essentially gave us a break on airfare and on lodging and was fine. You know, wasn't asking us to put him up at a 4-star joint.
He was at the Knights Inn up on 161.
He was very reasonable about that.
Of course, he'll listen to this podcast and be like,
Wait a minute.
I want $4,000.
But even with that, even with someone like him, we brought him in and we joke around that he was the one who made the money off of that event because he didn't quite bump the attendance away we thought he would. Nothing against Stuart. He was a great guest. But everybody wants some money, and you would be surprised at even smaller-term guests sometimes. They want several thousand dollars to appear.
Yeah.
Udo Kier is the example I've maybe danced around before, but he was the one who he wanted just enough that we thought this would be great to bring him in, but half the people in Columbus won't have any idea who Udo Kier is, and we'll end up losing our shirts because of that. And that's sad, because if we had done this, say, in Chicago and said, Udo Kier's coming in, probably have a lot of film fans who are like, I love Udo Kier. Oh, my God, that guy, let's do it. But
I don't know how many. I think you're overselling the rabid fandom of Udo Kier.
When the Cine family brought in Udo Kier for one night to introduce two of his films and to do a Q&A, they sold out almost instantly.
Blades. Udo Kier.
So there are in different cities, in bigger cities, there are people who know who Udo Kier is.
Yeah.
But in Columbus, you're selling it to a crowd who many of them won't know who it is. It's the way it is. But it limits us
not
in some ways
in
terms of who we can bring in.
Yeah.
You know, some people often say, well, why don't you just invite a bunch of people and see who comes in? Well, that doesn't do us
We'll give them each $4,000.
Or like, why don't you just tell people this is happening and see if they want to come out just for the hell of it and see if they show up? We can't do that.
Or advertise somebody and then say, oh, they couldn't.
Yeah. Or there's an assumption, I think, sometimes that like, oh, I see someone at a convention and they showed up gratis and why won't they show up for yours? And it's like, well, there's a lot of factors that go into that. Sometimes those people are showing up because they have a deal with a production company to promote their event and they're getting paid somehow by somebody, even if it's not for that specific event.
Well, it might just be rolled into their salary.
And sometimes also they show up and they don't charge, but they charge for autographs. You'll note that no marathon guests we've had have charged for autographs. So it's very complicated. And there's also the fact that we only have now around three.
Mike Olenek charged me $50 for an autograph.
Rightly so. Mike Olenek transcends guests.
Bastard.
Mike Olenek is like, to call him a guest would be an insult.
Okay.
He's a presence. He's a happening. So anyway, we only have 300 seats, and that limits you a bit about how much of a risk you can take.
Yeah.
We could bring in someone who wants, you know, $1,500, who's a minor star, and maybe it would be fun, but then we potentially also lose money.
Because it wouldn't necessarily boost sales.
No.
So having the guests or not have, you need to have a name to actually get some more butts in the seat.
Yeah. Or, you know, if we could potentially, maybe there's a dream scenario where we bring in someone really big a few years in a row, it works out, we find a way to make it work financially, because we never want to really like gouge people for tickets, because we want people to be able to afford to come to the event.
You know, off the air, you pitched the idea of offering blowjobs at the door.
I cannot confirm nor deny that story, but I'm sure there's another podcast at the end. By the time we get to the end of this, we'll be talking about that.
I've got some people that could probably help out with that.
I've met some of those people. Yeah, I'm sure they do. Anyway, that's a very long and windy way to say Sometimes people will look back at these two marathons and say, why can't you duplicate that? And
well, part of the thing with Bruce Campbell is you caught him at a time, what was it, 2002?
2002.
So he
let's,
was...
Well, let's talk about that. Okay. Because I think this wraps into what I want to do with you telling that.
Yeah.
So for those of you who listened to two podcasts ago, we talked about Joe Bob Briggs coming in 2001. Yeah. And he was a great guest. And he was the rarity because he almost didn't want an appearance fee from us because he was such a nice guy. He is a true class act. And if you ever see him on the streets, you should probably offer to buy him a beer or something, or a hooker. I don't know, because he's a sweetheart and a totally great guy. He's the total exception because most people want money to be paid for these things.
Yeah.
So hot on the heels of getting Joe Bob in, we thought we did fairly well with that. How do we build on that for the next year? And this was around the time you're probably going to say that Bruce Campbell had published its first book, If Chins Could Kill, yeah. Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, or
I think that's what it was called, yeah.
His autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going on a book tour at that point. And so this was back in the spring of 2002. I went to my boss, John Conti, one of the great things that's ever happened to them, or one of the great people that has ever been a part of the marathon. And I said to John, we should try to bring in Bruce Campbell. I called Bruce's then booking agent, very sweet woman, and she told me that he wanted $4,000. That was his fee. I said, let me get back to you about that. I tossed the number to John thinking, John's not going to want to pay $4,000. Mm. And he said, let's do it. It's worth the gamble, and it'll be worth it for the exposure for the theater. And I was kind of overjoyed because I thought, wow, that's way more than I ever thought we'd spend to bring a guest in. Now, to explain the Bruce Campbell story, let me...
Ticket prices, well, hold on real quick. I was going to ask, ticket prices, what, $30 this year?
For the Bruce Marathon, started out at $29 until the week of, although we never got to the week of, we sold out a month beforehand.
Okay. So basically you'd had 120 seats to cover the cost-ish.
Yeah, we went from, I think the year before, base ticket price was 18 to 20 in advance. Mm. We jumped ticket prices by about $10.
Wow.
And you have to think, too, film rentals back then were cheaper than they are now.
Yeah.
So we felt weird even charging $30, or I felt weird, but people bought it up. Now, to explain the Bruce Campbell experience, because this was kind of entering the big leagues of cult fandom for what we were doing, I want to defer to you because I think you have a good background and you've offered a good explanation before of where he was at that time in his career and how this all came about.
Well, everybody, at least in this podcast, who listen to this podcast are going to most recognize Bruce Campbell from the Evil Dead movies.
And by the way, just a note, I did my research this past weekend for this podcast. I watched all three Evil Dead films for the first time in a long, long, long while.
Nice.
Yeah.
Give me some sugar, baby.
Evil Dead 2, I had forgotten how fantastic of a film that is. I mean, I always liked it, but I don't make me proud to be an American.
I like the first one best.
I still
because it's played the straightest.
I still love Evil Dead. Yeah, I think Evil Dead 2, all three films, I think, make me want to have children and propagate and stimulate the economy and some other things. Anyway, so
he was most famous for the Evil Dead. He had also done stuff like Briscoe County Jr., so he had a run on television. But at this time, he was kind of in a dip in terms of his jobs. He had done the Evil Deads, and his last one he did was, 93, 95?
This was almost 10 years after Army of Darkness.
Yeah, so Army of Darkness had come out. Briscoe County Jr. was no longer on the air. And he was, I look at this as his I Am Spock moment. Because there was that time when Leonard Nimoy was saying, I publish a book, I'm not Spock. And then he embraced the fandom and published a book, I Am Spock.
One of the big things that was happening around this time, the DVD boom was in full flourish. And Anchor Bay had really taken it upon themselves to re-release all the Evil Dead films.
Yep. They had a really nice box set.
Was around the time when they did the Book of the Dead version of Evil Dead, because we gave away versions of that. And I think there was that slight surge in his cult popularity again because those things were being revived and there was the next generation after the generation that saw those in theaters was starting to pick up on this. So,
well, and it also comes to the time he was promoting a book.
Yes.
And at the same time, and I forget exactly where it fell in, I think he had made Bubba Hotep, but it hadn't come out yet,
it was about to come out. In fact, when he was there, he mentioned in his spiel at the end about supporting independent theaters, he mentioned this film, Bubba Hotep, I'm doing, which is rolling out right now. We couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Because it was like only playing in major cities at that point.
Yeah.
But that was, if you haven't seen it, by the way, it's a delightful little film by Don Coscarelli where he plays Elvis, who's residing in a retirement home, hiding from
everybody
and he meets this old, this guy played by Ossie Davis, who says that he's John Kennedy, even though Ossie Davis was black. Maybe John Kennedy was really black. We never even knew. And they fight a mummy. And it's really fun and actually kind of poignant in some ways.
It's a good movie. And it was him, I think it was when he was finally embracing his cult status. Later on, he went on to do stuff like Burn Notice, which is, and then he did his own movie, My Name is Bruce, you know, later on after that. But at this point, it was him sort of kind of restarting his cult career.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
If you look on the Evil Dead Book of the Dead version, there's that half-hour documentary he did called Phenalysis.
Yeah.
And it's all about him filming his appearances at the Alamo Drafthouse or at conventions and talking and trying to get into why people are so rabid about being fans.
Yeah.
So he was certifiably a cult hero in some ways.
Yeah.
I think what a lot of people expected, and I look, watching those three Evil Dead films this weekend, I look back on this and say, I was one of these people too. People saw the Evil Dead films, especially Part 2 and Part 3, and I think a lot of horror sci-fi fans, and maybe some other people too, said, wow, that guy's got leading man written all over him. Because he's good looking, he's charismatic, he's got a real good sense of humor about himself. He, as a physical actor, he's willing to make himself look dumb. But he's also, you know, doesn't have a lot of moments in those two films where he has to do this, but he can exude a certain charm and charisma and sex appeal.
Mm-hmm.
That, for various reasons, it never really happened.
Yeah.
I think in part because you get stereotyped as a B-movie horror actor from the beginning. But, I mean, there's probably some other reasons, too. And, I mean, I think Bruce at heart is a really good comedic ham actor.
Yeah.
I don't know that he's a great dramatic actor, necessarily.
Well, and I think at this point, because it was right around the time Spider-Man had come out, and he played...
the ring announcer.
He was the ring announcer. Yeah. So, I think there was an awareness that Sam Raimi had taken off.
Yeah.
And gone way past him, but was still kind of throwing him a bone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I said he was, and he was what, 40 about that? You know, 35, 40?
That's
at that
part
time?
Of it too, I think, is that by the time he gets to that age, he's not a 23-year-old hunk anymore.
He knows he's not going to be doing a movie with Julia Roberts.
And the indie horror film scene has kind of collapsed in some ways. It's not what it used to be in from 87 through 92.
Yeah.
So times are changing.
Yeah. So that's what, at the time, I remember when I think it was spurred on when you booked it. And I saw that he was coming. I contacted his publicist because I was writing for Film Threat. And I'd love for you guys to read this. You can go on Film Threat if Film Threat still existed. But Chris Gore, the asshole, decided to take the whole thing down and hold it hostage.
Yeah, Chris Gore. We're coming for Film Threat.
Chris Gore.
I have my Film Threat back issues, Chris Gore. I'm going to come and shove them down your throat.
No, it was all online. So I used through Film Threat. At the time, I was writing for Film Threat. So I used the Film Threat name, and I said, well, I'll publish it on Film Threat.
Half the audience is like, Film Threat? What is Film Threat?
Yeah, I know. Exactly. That's why it made like $30 in this Kickstarter campaign for Chris Gore's ego. So anyways, I went to his publicist, got him, and I did an interview, and it aired on Film Threat. It actually was published on Film Threat. It's a great interview. I should just resurrect it sometime. I should dig it out of my files and put it on my own website.
And here's the weird thing that happened with us.
And I think I promoted the marathon.
I think you're right.
on the thing. And he was really cool, but you could tell he was in the middle of a tour. He was busy, busy, busy.
Bruce, we booked him through his agent, his booking agent. And this was back in spring of 2002, and I spoke with her several times over the next 3 or 4 months. Very pleasant. A couple times when she actually called me up to talk about him, and then we ended up talking about Hollywood in general for a half hour.
Yeah.
Never heard from him. Some of you may have never heard this story before. So we hit probably about 3 weeks before the marathon, and I stop hearing from her. And I call her, and I'm getting no response. And we've sold out at this point.
Yeah.
And we're thinking, uh-oh, hope everything's okay. Jeez. At that time, one of our longtime cohorts who was working at the theater while also writing for a local publication told us that she contacted the publishing company from behind the book, St. Martin's Press, I believe.
Yeah, St. Martin's.
Independently, like you were doing, looking for a press contact.
Yeah.
And she was told that St. Martin's Press had taken over the booking of the tour. And then she got Bruce Campbell's phone number his cell phone number and gave it to us. And I remember the day finally when I'm sitting in the office at Studio 35 and Bruce Campbell calls me from the road at Studio 35 to go over the specs for the event.
Oh, okay.
Now, before then, we'd been given a list of things that we could do and couldn't do. And there were things like, he will only sign official Bruce Campbell merchandise. You can get the book and one other piece of official Bruce Campbell merchandise to sign. That's it.
Or boobs. I'm sure he would have signed boobs if you would have flashed
them. I wish someone would have brought that up. I wonder if he's changed that policy over the years that he will sign non-official Bruce Campbell merchandise.
I'll sign boobs. Anyone want to bring your boobs out? I'll sign them.
You sign your own sometimes, I've heard.
I don't have much boobs. I'm fat, but that's not where I keep it.
Anyway.
Right here. I'm squeezing it next to the microphone. Unlike you, you flat-chested bastard.
Yeah, it's all sinew. So he calls us, and all of a sudden, I basically get the impression that he has fired his booking agent. I also get the impression that the lines of communication between he and his booking agent had not been the greatest for a while. I would not be completely shocked, and if I ever meet Bruce Campbell again, maybe I'll ask him. Although he'll probably say, Studio 35, what the hell is that
He'll
place?
Be like, I don't know.
I don't remember. That was 2002. Please, I have better things to do. I wouldn't be completely shocked if he got booked at Studio and maybe didn't really know about it until late in the game. Or just saw it on the itinerary and didn't have specs. Or something happened because there was obviously a little bit of a communication gap in between...
My guess is
when
probably
the booking happened,
on his calendar,
yeah.
And he's like, oh, better figure this out.
Yeah, and as a result, I think there was a minor amount of scrambling before then. But it was fine. I mean, when he called, it was more along the lines of, here are the individual things I want as part of this. Some of them, it was the most intense list of, or the most specific list of requests we ever got from a guest, such as...
The green M&Ms all pulled out. And
yeah,
stuff
well,
like
well, he what he wanted, and I understand this, he wanted a uniform experience for everybody. Mm. So he said, what I need is like 3 bottles of water. What I need is a copy of my book that I can rest my left arm on when I'm signing the book so everybody gets the exact same angle of my arm. Which, you know, when you think about it, kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, here's the other thing you have to think of. From my memory, I believe most of his appearances on that tour were at bookstores, not at movie theaters.
Well, I remember he appeared
at movie theaters.
Well, I remember when I interviewed him, you could go on his website and you could see his itinerary.
Yeah.
And it was packed. I mean, it was like 5-6 days a week.
This was in a lot of ways,
and it was
like
mostly
you talked about, where I think you've said before, I think he was probably coming to terms with the fact that he would never really be a leading man necessarily.
Yeah.
While at the same time, he was fully embracing his B-movie status and publishing the book that in many ways was a huge high point of his career. Yeah. That's kind of an odd place to be at. We're probably psychoanalyzing the guy too much.
If he was here,
he'd probably say, what a bunch of horse shit,
you
please.
You guys are full of shit. No, but I don't think he ever ran away from his... I mean, he has I compare him to the Leonard Nimoy, I am Spock, I'm not Spock.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever tried to shun his B-movie status. I just don't think he had fully embraced it until this time.
So, we get that all taken care of. The oddball thing that happens is, the night of the event rolls around, and we hear he's going to be here at this time. So, we're waiting outside for him. He pulls up in his rental car. I shake hands with him. John Conti and I walk him into our office. As he's walking in, of course, there are people who are like, oh my god, it's Bruce Campbell! It's like, hey, what's up, hey?
I've been in the office at Studio 35. It's basically a bathroom.
Tiny. Yeah. In fact, today it
the
is.
The bathroom's bigger.
I today, think. I think it is the bathroom. They turned it into a bathroom about a year and a half later. So, there was a weird moment when we walked in, and I don't think I've ever publicly talked about this before. There was a weird moment when we walked in, and we start trying to just lay out, okay, well, we have this for you, and we have this. And he kind of like partially ran us down for something that was on our website that he claimed was on there that he didn't agree to. It was a very minor point. And it was weird because everything was very intense at that point, and I almost for a second wanted to tell him, hey, look, buddy, we're paying you to be here. Don't run us down when we're trying to make the best of this that we can. Not that it was a disaster leading up to that, but it was a weird tack to take for a guy who you've never met, who comes in, who's appearing at your thing. And it threw me for a second, like, excuse me?
Well, that's what he was doing.
At
I mean, he scoured. He, I think, took it upon himself to police what was written about him because I had a quote of his wrong. And he, after I published the FilmThread article, I mean, within a day, he was emailing me about something I had missed.
Which is really interesting when you think about it.
I've never had somebody read their own stuff that quickly.
No. And I wonder how much of that was due to the transition of his booking agency or booking agent.
That's possible.
Or any of that stuff. And how much maybe he was being really hyper aware of how he was being presented around there.
Yeah.
Because it's weird. You watch that documentary and it's all about him kind of traveling around and having a good time with the fans. And then I remember watching that before the event and thinking, oh, this guy does this all the time. He's got this.
Yeah.
So for when you tell me that and combined with the experience we had, I still think to this day that any kind of like minor little chafing from that night, at least with us, was just, we're catching him at a time when he's trying his schedule is packed and he's trying to catch up on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's not me saying Bruce Campbell is an asshole. That's me
saying,
he
had a lot on his plate then.
That's me saying it was just kind of weird for a second. Now, all that being said, and I've said this before to people I've told the story to, even with that minor bit of gruffness, he was great with the crowd.
Oh, he was fantastic. A fantastic guest.
And that's all that really matters in the end is the crowd loved him, and he did very well. Now, here, I remember there was an article written that year by Rob Harvilla. Do you know Rob Harvilla? Or do you remember him? Rob Harvilla used to write for the other paper. Now he went on to write for, I think, Pitchfork in New York, the big music website. And he does stuff for like Deadspin and other places like that now. Rob wrote a really great article where he did a diary of a 24-hour horror marathoner. He showed up to the event and he, about a week later in the other paper, wrote like, 11:45, I settled into my seat, blah, blah, blah. 1:15, this movie ends, crowd is like that. 2:30, I go out to get some pizza. He talked to me briefly. And it was a cool blow-by-blow of what it's like to stay through the entire event.
Mm-hmm.
What I think was funny was that, number one, the picture of Bruce for the article was Bruce obviously looking at the cameraman who walked in just for the event and holding his hand up like, I'm not taking a picture. And Rob's description of Bruce was, Bruce Campbell is here with the audience. He doesn't really seem to want to be here that much or like us that much, but he tells a lot of stories, but it seems like a performance. And I think that's interesting that he was a big marquee guest, and in a lot of ways, Bruce Campbell put us over the top in terms of we sold out.
Yeah.
And that planted the seed in people's minds that, oh, wow, we got to buy tickets the next year because they sold out.
Yeah.
Joe Bob, when he came in, was such a benign is not the right word to use, but he was such a low-key presence.
Yeah.
Joe Bob, we came in, I told the story before, we forgot to get him a table to sit down and sign autographs. He didn't care. He was like, I'll just stand here by the concession stand. I'll hang out.
Yeah.
So when you go from guy who's just there to hang out and will kind of roll with the punches and doesn't even want money, to a guy who has a extremely regimented set of requirements for his appearance, and he wants a good chunk of money, and who wants all this stuff, it's a weird transition. I don't think the fact that his Q&A was much more of a patter and performance-based, I don't think that made it bad at all. The crowd obviously really liked it.
Oh, yeah.
But if you compare him with, like, George Romero the next year, Romero, again, a guy who just kind of came in and answered questions, and I'm sure a lot of them were questions he answered before.
Oh, yeah.
But with him, it felt more like, hey, it's cool to see you guys. It's fun to be here. Bruce, I think, had a very strict itinerary of what he did at each appearance. And again, I'm not blaming him for doing that. It's interesting to look at that dynamic of how a guest interacts with the crowd, in that I do think that what Rob Avila wrote was true. There was a very performance-based aspect to what Bruce did, even down to the lines he said, like when, because he introduced Evil Dead briefly, and then after that, he came back for the Q&A. And I think some of the lines he had, some of the intros he had, you could tell he said this a lot before, and he's got this down to like a script almost.
Well, like I said, when you looked at his itinerary, you know, he was doing this 4, 5, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
And he had done it for several weeks before that. So you're going to fall into routine.
Absolutely.
Once you do that. And one of the things you do, one of the things he did, and I think which affects it being rehearsed, looking rehearsed, is you know what all those questions are going to be. So
yes.
He covers them in his speech. And he even ends it. I remember at the end, his final thing, he says, for those of you who want Sam Raimi to do Evil Dead 4.
Tell him not to do Spider-Man
3. Tell him
3.
Not to do Spider-Man 2 or 3 or whatever.
And
he'll do that. And then he left.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He was impressive in that we scheduled Roman Polanski's The Fearless Vampire Killers as the film that played during his autograph session.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it was a weird thing where he didn't want a line forming out the door. And I think he was used to a bookstore appearance, so he said, here's what I want you to do. As each person comes into the theater when they're checking in, give them a number. And then I want only like 10 people at a time to be in line. I don't necessarily agree with that still today, because it would have been no big deal if we had a line going out the door and down the block. The next year with Romero, we did that, and it was okay. I mean, we had a couple noise complaints, but it wasn't horrible.
Yeah.
But it ended up what we had to do. This was so weird. It felt like I was calling out bingo numbers. We had numbers 1 through 10. They got in line. And then right as number 10 was about to get his autograph or her autograph, I had to go in the theater during Fearless Vampire Killers and say, numbers 11 through 20. And then 15 minutes later, numbers, you know, number 21 through 30.
Yeah.
It worked smooth. And I'll give him credit for this. Fearless Vampire Killers is right under 2 hours. When we started that film, he started signing autographs. When the credits rolled on that film, he was done.
Yeah.
And no one complained like, oh, Bruce was a jerk. It was like, it felt like, this is cool. I get to meet him. It's neat. I shake hands. You get that experience. So credit to him. He had that down to a science in case of that. I was impressed. Now, can we talk about the other guest for that year?
Sure.
Because you don't even know who it was, do you? So here's how the booking for the marathon went. We had Bruce Campbell booked. We had, in the lineup, we had Stuart Gordon's Dagon booked as what was the Ohio premiere of it at that point. And, you know, the lineup we had was pretty fantastic. Dagon, we had Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, the original Haunting, H.G. Lewis's 2000 Maniacs, the original The Hills Have Eyes, Carnival of Souls, Fearless Vampire Killers, Dracula Has Risen
Carnival
from the Grave, Squirm. And we were looking for one final film. And so around that time, this critically acclaimed werewolf movie called Dog Soldiers.
I do remember. Oh, was that this one?
That was this one. Dog Soldiers was making its way around theaters. It had had a one-night premiere on the Sci-Fi Channel that summer.
Yeah.
But it was still only doing theaters. So that August, I contacted the distributor and said, hey, could we get a showing of this and would it be a premiere? They immediately answer back and they said, yeah, actually, you can have it. And the producer, David E. Allen, will be coming out for it.
Wow.
I immediately emailed back and said, we're bringing Bruce Campbell out. We really can't afford to do this, actually, because we don't have any more money. And they said, no, he'll pay his own way out. Flabbergasted by that. So David Allen and his partner in crime, I forget the guy's name, they came out and they showed up at the marathon around 2 o'clock or so. And they wanted to come and just be part of the event, which was really cool. And David was kind of at the time was kind of a low level producer and was trying to get, his company set up a little bit more. Neil Marshall, of course, directed the film.
Mm.
He's the one who went on to great renown. I'm not sure what David Allen is doing today, but incredibly nice guy, incredibly down to earth guy. He came. We had this weird, awkward moment where he had been there for a while. And when Bruce Campbell came in to the event, when we had his moment in the office with us, I'm going to paint Bruce as an asshole now, but I'm sure he can get over this. When he came into the office with John and I, David Allen was standing there. And David Allen, like any kind of industrious producer, wants to pitch Bruce Campbell on something. So, but all he did was he says, oh, hey, how you doing? And I just turned and said, oh, hey, Bruce, this is David Allen. He's the producer of Dog Soldiers. We're premiering at this. And David Allen wanted to give him like a pen from Dog Soldiers. And Bruce just kind of blows him off and says like, oh, yeah, we go way back. Yeah. Yeah, Bruce is going to challenge me to a fight or get on me on Twitter now.
Don't worry. I don't think Bruce is paying this much attention to his stuff.
I felt kind of mortified that he would just blow this guy off, because it wasn't like, hey, here's eccentric guy who walks in off the street. It was me saying, oh, hey, by the way, this is our other guest. He just wanted to say hi, and that was it. David Allen didn't even say like, hey, Bruce, would you be in my movie?
Yeah, here's my script.
He just wanted to give him like a pen, and I had to kind of like get David Allen in a corner afterwards and say, I'm sorry, I hope he wasn't an asshole to you, but he's probably under pressure and he's probably got the bullshit detector up and he probably, you know, whatever like that. Anyway, Bruce did his thing, and then we showed Dog Soldiers after Fearless Vampire Killers. So Bruce Campbell's long gone by this point. Dog Soldiers plays, audience totally digs it, they eat it up, and then David Allen and his partner
they lapped it up.
What turned into a 45-minute Q&A afterwards, because we thought, they deserve this. You know, they've been here for the whole time, and let them go with it. And it was really fun. And they actually stayed almost through the rest of the marathon with us, which is rare for guests to do, even small-time guests.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were great. And the audience loved the movie, and they were very appreciative of it. Because they also did – didn't they also do – what's the the period werewolf movie. Ginger Snaps. Didn't they do? Weren't they involved in Ginger Snaps?
I'm not too sure, actually.
I can't remember whether they were or whether they were just praising it. I can't remember.
I think they were praising it because it came out around the same time.
Okay. Well, one thing that's interesting about, and this is a little side story of Bruce Campbell, is...
Primitive screwhead.
But I did...
Hey, Bruce, I'm calling you out now, just FYI. This is how I'm going to make my bones in my career.
I said to you off the air, I think, the only times that I've had a chance to speak personally with Bruce has been when he's trying to promote something.
Yeah,
which that's the way the media works.
Yeah,
so he's promoting his
really?
Book.
No, yeah, I know. Shut up.
Then a second time, about 6 years later, he came out with a documentary. My Name Is Bruce, or the movie. My Name
the movie,
is Bruce.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
movie, and he was doing a lot of promotion for that. And also at the time, he was on Burn Notice, and so he was getting a little bit of a resurgence with his television career.
Yeah,
and I was approached to interview him. I was approached. I didn't approach them. Because I was writing for Film School Rejects at the time. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. So I interviewed him. And he was so much more laid back.
I'm sure.
During this interview, he was very, very sweet and very nice and very personable. Whereas when I interviewed him back in 2002, he was very much...
Everything I have ever seen him in, interview-wise, print, all the press tour around Ash versus Evil Dead... He seems exactly like the guy that everybody else knows. And everything he's ever said about interactions with fans and appearing at things is like, this is fun. That was the misleading thing I think about when you watch Finalysis. I watched it again last night. He appears at the Alamo Drafthouse, and he's walking into the theater, and there's a huge crowd outside, and he's just bullshitting with the crowd, and he's posing for pictures, and he's like, okay, I got to go in now. So when he showed up at our theater, it was like, we thought that's the guy that was going to show up. And the guy that showed up was like, military precision, let's roll, come on.
Like I said, when he had that, and you had said this about him having, he knew what he was going to be asked, and so he's prepared for that.
Yeah.
And he'd been doing it for 5-6 days a week, for weeks. And I remember the first question I asked him, or second question I asked him when I actually interviewed him, I asked him about, because I said, I like to do this whenever I interview somebody, I like to try and find something to ask him that no one ever's asked him.
Did you say top or bottom?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like Alice Cooper once. I asked him, "Are you going to be golfing at all in Columbus?"
Oh yeah,
because he's a huge golfer, and very few people know that, and they wouldn't think to ask him that.
Yeah.
So I asked Bruce Campbell about the short films he did with Sam Raimi, not Within the Woods, but stuff like Toro, 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 stuff like that. He was just like, "What are you?" I mean, it caught him so off guard. And he almost stopped the interview because it was in,
you could tell
he's like, you're not asking the questions I expect. What about the fucking Evil Dead is what I want to know.
So
then I just went right into what he was expecting. But I think that's just, I've not hung out with him as a person, but I like to give him the benefit of the doubt, especially how nice he was in 2008 when I interviewed him, that I think he was on autopilot through that whole thing.
I agree. And I think it would be interesting if we brought him out today when he's not in the middle of a huge tour around something.
Yeah.
What the atmosphere would be like.
Yeah.
And again, people would love him. I mean, some people listening out there are going to say, so, Joe, basically you're complaining that you weren't best buddies with him at the marathon. Oh, darn. What a fucking disappointment. Because, Joe, that's right. You paid $40 to come see him, didn't you? Oh, no, that's not right. Actually, you made money off of this thing. Oh.
Somehow Bob Lundegaard is now in the studio.
Oh, Joe, what a huge complaint that you made a little cash off of him coming in and he wasn't your best pal. Didn't give you a noogie or something and be like, little buddy, come on, let's go. Actually, one of the weird things during that event was...
He did give you a
noogie. For the first time, we set up a wireless mic system.
Uh-oh.
And partway through his Q&A, interference came in. And we had this loud buzzing sound like...
Wow.
And I didn't know what to do. And so there's videotape of this of me. I start walking him back up the aisle like I'm like, I don't know what to do because I don't know why I did that. He finally says, well, turn it off. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Shit. Which probably made me look like I was a complete fucking moron. He did the rest of the Q&A without his microphone as a result. And everything was fine after that, but very much in keeping with the weirdness of the whole thing. Now, okay, the event itself, you were at this one. Do you remember anything else? Any other high points from this?
Oh, let's see. I mean, we already covered Bruce Campbell and David Allen. Oops, you can hear me flipping through there.
This is an interesting lineup, I think, because this was one of the last lineups where I think me in booking things where I relied so heavily on classic material.
Yeah. I think I left after Uzumaki, which I really enjoyed.
Uzumaki,
so
we
bizarre.
Had that. That's right. Yeah, that was a fun premiere.
And the reason is because I'd seen Evil Dead, it was getting late, and at this time I was not making my way all the way through.
You were getting old and feeble at that point.
I was starting
to
get old and feeble. I was in my 30s.
Well, and
time.
I think this was a definite breaking point at 2002 where the what is considered a classic film starts getting a little bit more recent because time is rolling on. You'll notice that in the lineups in subsequent years that there's not as much stuff from the, you know, the 50s and the 60s. This lineup had four, five films from the 60s. We would probably never do that today.
No.
This was before the big 80s resurgence in terms of horror films from that decade.
Yeah.
But it was a fun time. I mean, this was such a weird thing for us to sell out 1 month in advance.
Yeah.
And there was a real excitement. Now, the odd thing was that once Bruce left, we had a good chunk of people that left, too. The end of that marathon.
Well, that's going to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, more than usual, though. More than other guests. The next year we didn't have as much.
Bruce had the exact same effect on the audience that Serbian film did, is what you're saying.
Yes. Bruce Campbell equals Serbian film. I'm calling you, Bruce. Come on. Defend yourself. Come on our podcast next time. Really. The next year was not as big of a disparity between who bought tickets and then who stayed. But it was an overwhelming success, and it finally brought us into the next year in which I got to fulfill a very long-held dream of mine. Way back when I first started doing marathons, when I first started organizing them, I always said, and I think I've mentioned this before, that if there was one guest I could get, it would have been George Romero, because he was a hero to me.
Never heard of him.
And he's this Cuban-American, tall.
Oh, yeah.
Limp, carries a gun sometimes, eye patch, you know. his films, you've heard me talk about Dawn of the Dead ad nauseum, but his films meant so much to me and still to this day.
I thought the Texas Chainsaw was your
favorite. Oh, according to Tim, yes. Texas Chainsaw is my favorite film of all time. R.I.P. Gunnar Hansen, by the way.
Yes.
It's very sad.
Poor Gunnar Hansen.
Those of you.
Or as the guy who nobody knows his name who played Leatherface in two of the non-sequels, boohoo. Did you hear about that?
What? The
guy, who whatever his name is, it's like a Russian name or Polish name or something. He played Leatherface in the remake and then The New Beginning.
Oh, yeah. He died too?
No, he just killed his career is what he did. He tweeted out last night or the night before, he tweeted out, boo-hoo. And
bastard.
And then when people kind of went after him, he then responded in a real dickish way. Which is generally not what you want to do. Especially
he cannot hold Gunner's jock.
Yeah.
I saw Texas Chainsaw again at the drive-in, ironically enough, a little over a month ago.
The original. With Gunner.
And I to see that at a drive-in for the first time is a pretty fantastic thing. The Gunnar Hansen's performance in that film, you can overrate these things sometimes, but it is phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, the things he brought to that role in one film, the range of emotions, the way he expresses himself just through little tics and mannerisms, and it's fantastic. Anyway, we're talking about Horror Marathon number 5.
Yeah.
So, Horror Marathon number 5, George Romero is the one name. And so I remember in the spring of 2003, I worked with John and I put together a package, kind of a pitch package essentially, to send to Romero and his wife at the time, Christine, who was doing his bookings, and they were living in Pittsburgh still at that point.
Yeah.
And basically sent it to them and said, here's who we are. Here's what we want to do, and would you be interested in coming out? Christine Romero called John, said George would love to. At one point, we actually bandied around the idea, believe it or not, of having Romero and Savini come out, but costs would have prevented that from happening. Yeah. Laugh along, some of you Savini people, including me, I guess. I made a joke about this. You think Savini will appear for a can of Coke.
Maybe not a can.
Hey! How do you like that, Bruce Campbell? Stephen King.
Yeah. Fuck you, Stephen King and Werner Herzog. Yeah, Werner Herzog. We're running into I'm scared.
So she called John and said, he'd love to as long as he's available, and this is how much it'll cost. And it was about $4,000 again. So we said, let's do it. And this was a huge dream come true to bring him out. And I tell you this.
Did he drive?
Yeah, he drove.
Okay.
I believe
it seems silly to fly from Pittsburgh to Columbus.
I had always heard stories at that time that Romero wasn't big into flying.
Well, I mean, I would imagine it's like you're at that point, an hour in the airport.
Yeah.
You know, 20 minutes in the air. But by the time you could have driven in the time it would take.
He drove out. He and his wife both drove out. This marathon, I look back at very both fondly and mournfully, because I look back at this one, and of all the marathons I've had a part of, even to this day, this is the one that came together in every possible way, with one exception, which I'll talk about at the end. And it didn't really have anything to do with the event itself. In terms of the film lineup, the guest, the decorations, the concept, because we went with the whole Studio 35 as quarantine zone for a zombie invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And we had friends of ours. I had a friend who worked at Patel who got us hazmat suits. I dressed up.
He created real zombies.
Yeah, he created real zombies.
Set him on the loose for that weekend.
I dressed up in a lab coat that had blood all over it, and they had me in handcuffs.
Did you just happen to have it lying around?
I just happened to have it.
Somebody else's blood? I don't know.
They had me in handcuffs before the event. They led me around like two guys in hazmat suits with quote-unquote rifles, like water gun rifles. Like, they had captured me against my will, and I was being forced to run this whole quarantine.
This was in your performance art section of...
No, not even that. It was like a cool concept to run with, and it wasn't even like we carried it through the whole event.
You should do that more. You and Bruce in the marathon should show up in like Hannibal Lecter wheelies.
Maybe someday. Well, we had think about it too. Back then, we were sold out 3 weeks in advance. We didn't have to worry about selling tickets at all, and so we could spend more time on doing, or I could spend more time on doing crazy shit. Yeah. God, I'd love to do that again. But in terms of the concept, the decorations, the guest, Romero, the second guest, because this was the year we held the world premiere of Kevin S. O'Brien's Sandwich, the legendary, up to that point, unfinished fourth Bread film, the one that's the parody of Marv Newland's Godzilla vs. Bambi, which was great. Kevin showed up, and Kevin O'Brien wore a tuxedo for the entire event because it was his world premiere.
Wow.
Dave Zucchini was there. I didn't even know Dave at that point that well, but Dave worked on Sandwich, and now Dave and Bruce and I are best friends. Best friends.
And I eat sandwiches all the time.
And you eat sandwiches?
And we're friends.
Dave Nedro, this guy named Dave Nedro, who would become a benefactor of ours some 4 or 5 years later, he showed up because he worked on the film. I often told Kevin O'Brien in years after that this marathon felt like a closing of a circle. Because when I first came into the marathons, I loved George Romero. Dawn of the Dead was one of the first films at a marathon I saw that deeply affected me. And Night of the Living Bread was this really cool film, and I kind of got to become friends with Kevin through watching this at the marathons and getting to know
him. Kevin local still?
He was, I think he was in Cleveland at that time.
Okay.
Had not yet moved to Australia. So, and I said, it was kind of cool that I finally got to bring in my dream guest, Romero, and I also got to have the world premiere of your film, and you were so influenced by Romero. Kevin O'Brien, by the way, we've said this before, but if you didn't know, he plays an extra in Day of the Dead. Mm-hmm. In the underground zombie invasion scene, when they finally come in at the end, he's in there for like a frame or two, you know, but he was one of the people who won the opportunity to be an extra. And Kevin loves Romero's films. I mean, obviously he loves Romero's films.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, bringing you in and being able to have you and the people who made Sandwich and the Night of the Living Bread cast all there at the same time to kind of finally close this up on a big, momentous event for it was really, really cool.
Well, Kevin had dealings with Romero before because didn't Bread end up on one of the DVDs?
Well, the story originally, when the 1990 remake, the Savini-directed remake of Night of the Living Dead, played on syndication.
Yeah.
That film is only about 90 minutes. They needed something else to fill the final 8 to 10 minutes of the time slot, even with commercials.
Yeah.
So the company that was doing syndication arranged a deal to have Night of the Living Bread show in that 2-hour time slot, which is kind of cool when you think about it. I remember seeing it
for an independent filmmaker.
I remember seeing it on Channel 28 when that happened. You'd never see that today, mostly because
they'd fill it.
Channels like that don't even show syndicated films. Yeah. But then when Elite Entertainment did their huge monumental remastering of Night of the Living Dead, the one that was like at the time the definitive remastering that finally revealed, it wasn't just like a doopy 16mm, you know, grimy film. It actually looks really nice.
Yeah.
When they did that, they made an arrangement to put Night of the Living Bread on that, and they remastered it for that too. So if you bought the Elite Entertainment DVD or Laserdisc at the time, you got Night of the Living Bread on that too. So Romero was always very aware of the bread phenomenon, and I think Kevin had spoken with him a few times in passing. So everything came together.
Did you get a picture of Kevin S. O'Brien handing like George Romero any bread?
I don't have a picture, but Kevin
missed
might.
Opportunity.
Kevin might. I hope Kevin does.
Kevin better.
Kevin, if you're listening, I have your email address. I could just email you, but I'm. This is much more passive aggressive and fun.
That's right.
So yeah, this to me.
You know what my favorite Romero movie is?
Monkey Shines.
No.
There's Always Vanilla.
Oh, Creepshow.
Creepshow. Creepshow was also showed on the drive-in bill with Texas Chainsaw, the one I saw a month ago.
I love Creepshow.
Nightmare on Elm Street, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Creepshow. Mm. All four. My favorite Romero film is obvious. My second favorite Romero film, it's a toss-up between Martin and Day of the Dead. Although I hold a very special place for Knight Riders.
I like the Crazies, too.
Crazies is fun, too, yeah. The lineup for this event... We did the zombie invasion theme, so we had Night of the Living Dead. We had Versus, which if you've never seen it, at the time it was kind of a big film on the festival circuit. It's Yakuza thugs taking a guy out into a forest to execute him, and they don't realize it's a zombie forest. And there's just, it's kind of like akin to Deathgasm in that it has all the little bits and pieces that you would expect a marathon audience to love. There's samurai sword fights, there's, you know, wild acrobatics, there's bloodshed, there's gore, there's time travel. It's really fun and crazy. We had the Ohio premiere of Ichi the Killer, the infamous Takashi Miike film. This was when Miike was really breaking through with U.S. audiences. Mm. We had the Midwest premiere of Stuart Gordon's King of the Ants, which is not a traditional horror film, but is a very brutal film in a lot of ways. And then I Walked with a Zombie, Dead Alive, the then new 35mm print of Fulci's Zombie, Freaks, The Last Man on Earth, Pieces, and my fave, The Hunger, which even on the videotape, people are complaining that I play The Hunger too much. Ha ha ha, it'll come back soon, kids, don't worry.
I'm sure. It'll play at 4 in the morning.
This was fun, too, in that I noted at the end, I forget how intentional this was, but we essentially kind of did a modern history of the zombie film, because the 12th film we played was Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
At that time, I'm going to get in tons of trouble for this. At that time, Richard Rubenstein, the producer of Dawn of the Dead.
We've been through this.
Oh, yeah. Discussion. Oh, yeah. That's right. Because we talked about Night of the Living Dead, or Dawn of the Dead at the Night of the Living Drexel.
Yeah.
At the time, he still was not licensing screenings. So we played it, but we didn't advertise it. Yeah. So, which was fun. But we basically went Last Man on Earth. Mm-hmm. Which Romero has said was an inspiration for Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Then we had the sequel, Dawn of the Dead. Then we had Zombie, which in Italy was known as Zombie 2, because in Italy, Dawn of the Dead was known as Zombie. And Zombie is probably the greatest Dawn of the Dead ripoff film there is. And I say that because it's actually a very fun film.
I enjoy Zombie. Zombie's a fun movie.
And then Dead Alive, which became kind of the apex in for a lot of people of the modern zombie film up to that time. Oh, and we had I Walked with a Zombie too, which was your early zombie, which is not even the Romero type zombie. Because people forget now, George Romero essentially invented what we think of as the modern zombie.
Well,
essentially,
the modern zombie was just known as a ghoul. Like you go back to the old EC horror comics, there were the dead rising from the grave and attacking the living. Those were just called ghouls. Yeah. They weren't as directly eating the flesh of the living
I Walked with a Zombie. It's much more of like almost like a sleepwalker type deal.
Well, zombies, go back to White Zombie. It's that sort of mind control.
Yeah. So, what to say about this event itself? My memories of George Romero are we were running behind. Surprise, surprise. I'm up on what we used to call the luxury lounge at Studio 35, which was on top of the bar section back in the old days. Mm-hmm. We had set up chairs and a couch at one point. Yeah. So the staff could sit up there if they wanted to. Bruce Campbell famously the year before when he was doing his Q&A looks up and he says, wow, this is a fun place. What's this place up there? Like the VIP lounge or something? Yeah. He actually asked to see it before he left. So at the Romero Marathon.
Won't you stay there for weeks?
And we never let him go. We replaced him with the man you see today, the much nicer, kind, codgerly old dude.
Just like Stephen Hawking.
And Stephen King. Coming for you, Stephen King. Twitter. anyway, I'm standing up there watching the trailer block for, I think, Night of the Living Dead, and Romero and Christine, his wife, come in. And it's dark, so I only, like, minorly see them. And I was like, oh, hey, nice to meet you both. I'm so sorry, we're running a bit behind. Do you guys want to stick around? And they said, well, why don't we go back to the hotel, and we'll come back in about 45 minutes. Is that okay? Because they were staying not too far away. I said, okay, that's cool. His wife never came back, so I never really got to spend time with Christine. And I kind of regret that, because you see her in his films all the time, and she's very nice. And we kind of handled the whole process up to that point.
Yeah.
He came back. I'm mildly starstruck because Bruce Campbell, it's like, I like your films, but I've never been, I was never in the Bruce Campbell cult.
Yeah.
I love his films. I watching Evil Dead 1, 2, and 3, I think they're tremendous fun, and I love watching him perform, but I've never been part of the fan base where it's like, oh my God, Bruce Campbell is God.
Yeah.
I like him a lot, but that's it. Romero, on the other hand, I'm like,
is God.
Is he God? He's huge. Romero's like 6'7", you know? I mean, he towers over me. So he comes in, and I said, George, nice to meet you again. Come on in. Sorry for the delay. Can I get you anything? He says, oh, could I get a, what was it? A Great Lakes Elliott Ness beer. So I go back and pour it for him into a glass. And then he's like, I'll tell you what, why don't we go outside for a few minutes? Immediately, I think, oh no, we can't have alcohol outside because Clintonville's alcohol regulations were very strict back then.
Yeah.
So I say, well, let me pour that into a paper cup because I don't want to get George Romero in trouble.
Let me put it in a round bag.
Yeah, all of a sudden, the beer starts foaming out of the cup, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm fucking up my one time with George Romero, which wasn't.
To this day, George Romero goes, let me tell you about how this kid tried to pour me a beer one time.
What a jerk, God. No, George was a total sweetheart. He was such a great guy, and it was weird when we finally introduced him because night was ending.
Yeah.
We played Night of the Living Bread right after, for those who hadn't seen it up to that point, so they got the immediate context. And it's great because the tape we have of it, we encourage people to throw bread at that point, and people like went nuts once again throwing this. It's amazing when you look back at the reaction to that film in 2003, and even 6 years later, how it got a little docile again in terms of how they reacted to things. But the plan was, and I told Romero this, I said, George, here's how we're going to do it.
Duck.
George, here's how we're going to do it, okay? Because you and me, I run the show. No. I said, George, I learned one thing with Bruce Campbell last year, and that's I have to take charge. And then George like bounced me like a basketball because I'm so short and said, get out of here, little man. What are you doing? God, what a dick. Anyway, I said, here's what we'll do. You stand back here in the bar area. I'm going to go down after Night of the Living Bread, and I'm going to give a small introduction to you. I'll motion for you. You come down. We're there. And my plan was I wanted to go down and basically talk about my experience with Romero, as in what his films meant to me.
Yeah.
To say, most of you love his stuff. When I was a kid, his films affected me in this way. And it's really cool to have him out. Ladies and gentlemen, George Romero. I started in that pattern. And at this point, one of our longtime attendees, who will remain nameless, not Tim Martin, don't worry, Tim, decides of his own volition back in the bar to say, okay, go George, now. And so Romero starts walking down like 30 seconds into my intro, and I'm like, well, here he is, George Romero. When he came down finally, that's when I kind of gave my spiel. But now he's right beside me, so it's like, hey, George, you mean a lot to me, you know? The one cool thing we did, and I still take pride in this, and I know he thought it was kind of cool, was in 2002, Sight and Sound magazine in England had done their every 10 year poll for the greatest films of all time.
Yeah,
and they published the polls. They published each individual person who enters or submits. They published their top 10 films, and lo and behold, who's one of the people in the director category who submits a poll? But George Romero. So way back when that came out, I said, wouldn't it be cool if we could show the trailers for his 10 films, his top 10, without telling him.
Yeah.
As a surprise.
Nice.
We found the trailers through Bruce, Bartu, for all but three of the films, and the three were pretty rare trailers. But they were things like the one of the ones we couldn't find was King Solomon's Mines, the original.
He
had things like Touch of Evil, Polanski's Repulsion, The Quiet Man, a couple others, you know, not all horror films at all. He had Tales of Hoffman, the great Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger film, which we didn't have a trailer for, but just got a big remastering redo by Martin Scorsese in 4K. Tales of Hoffman is the film that Romero said convinced him he could do anything as a filmmaker when he saw it as a child.
Nice.
So we showed that trailer reel, and then he did the Q&A, and it was pretty great. The one regret I have in all these, and I think we would change this when we get another guest in that has any clout, is I didn't sit down and talk to them. Mm-hmm. It was more like, and here he is to do a Q&A. Bruce Campbell was the same way. At the end, I kind of cringe when I watch the tape where it looks like there are no more questions, and Romero turns to me and he's like, anything else? And I just kind of said, I don't know, do you want? And Romero kind of says, oh, you're running the show. Like, what are you going to do? And I think I kind of got hypnotized there for a second by the crowd energy. George, I will give him credit. George signed autographs for 3 hours.
Wow.
He sat there, and we even said, George, we can limit this to 1 or 2 items per person. And he said, well, why don't you do like 3? So people brought 3 items each, and 90 minutes in, we said, hey, George, do you want to take a break? Because Romero at that time was like in his early 60s. Bruce Campbell was in his early 40s. A little bit of a difference. Romero's like, no, I'm fine. Just call the hotel. Tell my wife I'll be back later. He just trooped straight through signing autographs. And
he'd sign anything. So if you came up and you had
a
human leg.
Well, the funny part, some of you might not know this, but when Bruce Campbell came in, would not sign Bruce Campbell merchandise. Here's a minorly untold story. My partner in crime, Bruce Bartu, for decades has had celebrities he meets sign a baseball.
Yeah.
I forget how it started, but he will bring in a new, never used baseball and say, hey, I always have people I meet sign a baseball. Could you sign this for me?
Oh, they're not all on the same baseball.
No. Everybody gets their own baseball. And that's his collection. And most people are like, sure, yeah, go ahead. He brought one of these to see Bruce Campbell. We have videotape of this, and it's so great how it's framed, where the guy doing the videotaping is standing right by the concession stand, and he's got the camera on Bruce Campbell signing his last autograph, and then Bruce Campbell stands up to come and walk behind the concession stand to take a picture with John Conte and I.
Yeah.
Your publicity pose. As he's getting up and walking over, Bruce Bartu, who's been waiting patiently, walks up to Bruce Campbell, says, hi, would you mind signing this for me? And Bruce Campbell, in one fell swoop, he's getting up and he starts walking over to the concession stand. As he's walking, he's like, baseballs? No, I don't sign baseballs, please. And he blows right past Bruce Bartu, and Bruce Bartu is looking at him, and Bruce Bartu says, but like, I'm his godfather, pointing to me. He's like, he's my clone. And it's like that scene in The Simpsons where they rewind the tape footage of Milhouse. I think it's Milhouse. Ralph Wiggum's heart breaking. And Bart says, and you can see where it breaks right there. And it's just, it's kind of sad. It's like, wow. Oh, my God.
Would it have been more effective if you dressed him up in a little beanie and gave him a lollipop and go, Mr. Campbell, would you sign my baseball?
To this day.
Yeah.
And Bruce Bartu, for those of you who don't know, Bruce Bartu is the projectionist at the Wexner Center, has been for decades. They have a lot of famous people walk through there. A lot of pretty big names walk through there and do Q&As. In all his years of collecting autographs on baseballs, asking people, Bruce Bartu has been rejected by 2 people. The first was a minor starlet in the early 80s who he saw at the airport who was having her moment of fame and who basically went on to not a lot, and Bruce Campbell.
Aww.
So Bruce Campbell. Not saying you have to come out and autograph a baseball, but you broke a poor man's heart. He hasn't been the same since. He gets up at night sometimes and he just like screams Bruce Campbell baseball.
You should Bruce Campbell baseball. You should get a baseball and see if you can arrange to get Bruce Campbell to sign it for
you. We should bring Bruce Campbell back and say, before you go, Bruce, here in front of the audience, we have one last thing we just want to take care of. And see what he says. And then we should bring Patty Mullen back and say, Patty, let's talk about when you were Frankenhooker and you didn't want to be here.
And talk about how you wouldn't sign your crotch in one of the penthouse spreads.
And then we can settle all scores. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, George Romero stayed for 3 hours. He was fantastic. This whole event was great. There was one small thing that marred this event, and I don't always like to talk about this, but it definitely played a role in why there's no more Nightmare at Studio 35s. In the spring of 2003, my boss, John Conte, had been trying to sell the theater for some time. He had kind of lost a lot of his desire to run a movie theater. He'd been in the business for decades, and, you know, he had every right to want to get out.
Yeah.
And he sold it to a pair of 2 guys who were partners in business and more. Not that that's a knock on that, but they lived together, and they had long wanted to buy the theater, and so they did. And these guys had some means, and it was, you know, in a lot of ways, it was a weird period because we thought, oh, well, this should be good for the theater, I hope. Yeah, I mean, this will prod things along, and it everything seemed fine. Now, before he officially sold the theater to these two guys, we had booked the entire marathon. All the films were booked, Romero was booked, all that stuff. The first sign of problems I noticed was at the end of August, literally the day before I was about to make the flyer, I went to an all-night horror show in Delaware at the Strand that our buddy Vince Cornelius ran, which was a really great time. Went there, stayed up all night, came home, and I got a phone call that the new management wanted me to come in for a meeting. And I said, can you tell me what this is? I've been up all night. I'm a little tired. I'm going to make the flyer tonight. And they said, we want you to switch the date of the horror marathon to the end of September for a bye week on OSU's football schedule because they were showing OSU football games. I said, that's almost impossible. Everything's been arranged. We can't just talk to George Romero and say, oh, by the way, can you come in September instead?
Yeah.
Or we can't just say, oh, by the way, film prints, can we move all those to the end of September? I spent the better part of the day arguing this with these guys. Look, we can't just do this. I'm offering you a guaranteed sellout for this. Yeah. You're assuming that the Ohio State game is going to sell out no matter what. But really, one OSU game against a minor opponent is not that you're missing is not going to kill you. When I'm offering you big money and big concessions for 24 hours, not just for like three or four.
Yeah.
Finally convinced them this was okay, and things seemed okay until 3 days before the marathon. At that point, I get an email from the then management, and they said, just FYI, and this was handled very casually. It was like oh, and by the way, at the beginning of this horror marathon on Saturday, we want you to get up in front of the audience and announce that next year's horror marathon will be on the OSU bye week in the middle of September. And I said, can we just wait and talk about this? Because really, there's a lot of complicating factors that go into this. It's more than a year away. I'm sure we can try to figure out something that works best. And they said, no, you have to. You have no choice. And I said, well, I guess this is my last marathon then, because this is ridiculous, as for many reasons I said before. They told me, we wish you would respect the fact that we've been successful in other businesses. To which I said, I do, but I wish you would respect that I've been working in the movie theater business for almost 10 years, and I kind of know a little bit about what's going on. This engendered some bad blood for a few days, and this was the one scar on this event, was I went into that day knowing this was it for me. This was my dream. Everything comes together fine, but at the same time, it's like, shit, this is the end.
You could have totally gone out on top and walked away from this entire thing.
I could have gone out on top several times, and I stupidly keep coming back to it. Anyway, we get to the event, and the interesting thing is, as people are coming in, they pull me aside, and they said, hey, remember that thing we told you about announcing the new date? Let's hold off on that. This isn't what we thought it would be at all. This is way more like involved and intense, and like people were really into this. I don't know what they thought it was going to be. I mean, we had a sellout event for a ton of people.
Yeah.
But they said, let's hold off on that for the time being. I said, okay, I said, here's what I want to do. I want to get done with the marathon. I want to get paid. And then after that, I don't want to think about the marathon for 3 or 4 months. I just want to take some time off and do some other stuff. Yeah. Why don't we talk about it then? And we'll figure it out. And they said, okay, that's fine. So we agreed on that. At the end of this marathon, I made kind of a thank you and goodbye that was vague enough that if I left, you could look back and say, oh, that was a thank you and goodbye. I said something like, thank you for 5 great years and enjoy Dead Alive. I didn't say anything about next year.
Yeah.
Because even at that point, I still thought, I don't think I'm coming back. I don't think these guys get it. And I think they want to compromise the event because you don't do a horror marathon, especially in a college town, where at that time, no one came back to college until the end of September. You don't do it in the middle of September.
Yeah.
And my argument always was, well, what if Ohio State goes 1-3 or 1-4 in their first X amount of games and the interest is less, which actually happened the next year. They went 2-4 in their first 6 games and the interest was much less. But they always thought we can do both and we can always maximize our profits, in their words. So at the end of January 2004, I quit Studio 35 to begin teaching. And we didn't say anything about the marathons, although a couple times after the 2003 marathon, I was approached by one of the owners and asked for all the information I had about films we'd booked. And I said, I'd like to hold off on this because we talked about talking about it in the spring. I could kind of read the writing on the wall at that point. I left the studio at the end of January and several months later found out from an associate of mine who still worked there that they had approached her to book the next marathon. At that point, I was like, well, I guess I'm not coming back. I didn't think I was coming back, but the thought had entered my mind of like, what if I do? Because I love this event, and I don't want to see it die.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think these guys get it. And
was this when you sent that email?
I sent that email out. Yeah. And this led to, infamously, this led to the other paper writing an article about the whole kerfluffle. The article that the writer at the time claimed, when I asked him if he could hold off for maybe a week or two till I could announce something that was going to happen that fall, said, my editor will never let me get away with that. Like, oh yeah, because this is a huge story. This is like a mayoral race that I'm keeping
information for. Was he wearing a fedora that had press on? I'm sorry, this is way too important. I need to run to the phone booth and phone my story.
Ridiculous. And it
copy!
I was really honest with them, and I said, I told them the story I told you plus more, and that made me persona non grata at studio for a while. Mm. Oh, well, they're not there anymore, so I don't care. But as a result, this was the final 24-hour Studio 35 Horror Marathon that I ran. And boy, for a while there, I did think, this will be great. This is kind of going out on top. If I have to go out, this is a great way to go out. And I fully expected, even when Studio 35 announced that they were going to continue Night of the Living or Nightmare at Studio 35 as an all-night event, a 12-hour one, that bastard event counted. Even when they announced that, I still thought, you know what? I'm fine walking out on top and retiring until my buddy Bruce Bartu,
you idiot,
pulled me into the projection booth one night at the Wexner Center and led me down a road that continued. Wow. All of this into today, but that I think is a conversation for the next time when we talk about a certain all-night horror marathon that sprang up and the beginning of what has now become a full-time partnership between he and I.
Aww.
But just know, if I was wise, I would have walked away back then and been done with the marathons. And Bruce, I blame this on you. And Bruce Campbell, I blame it on you too.
Because it's because you didn't sign his goddamn baseball.
Thanks, Bruce Campbell. You primitive screwhead.